Hello everyone, my name is Amandine Flax and welcome to a new episode of Entrepreneurs Playing Games podcast edition. Every 2 weeks I host a live video stream where I deep dive into startup founders' journey after playing video games with my guest. Here is the audio version of our discussion. If you are interested in the full video, be sure to check out and follow my YouTube channel at youtube.com/AmandineFlax. And for any questions, suggestions, or just to say hi, you can find me on Twitter at AmandineFlax or at EntrepreneursPG. In today's episode, I am joined by Freddy, Chief of Staff at Oyo. I'm super happy to have you here today, especially as we are both part of Backed VC Scout community, and we never managed to sit down and have a chat. That's a shame.
Yeah, that's my fault, I'm afraid. I was explaining to you beforehand that when I joined the Backed community, which is an amazing thing, I think, shout out to the team there. Backed is a very credible firm, not only because of the investments they've made, but actually I've been really impressed with the community they've managed to build up. All that goes down to Daisy. Shout out to you, Daisy.
If you're around, yep, we're really thinking about you right now.
It says a lot about the way that they approach the environment, that they want to invest in people. And it's not just about deciding what the answer is and kind of making investment decisions that are walking away. But they understand that in order to compete in, the modern funding environment, mm-hmm. they've got to do a bit more than just put cash on the table. Yes. And as I said to Daisy when I joined, I was at the same time starting my job at Oyo this time last year. And I was going to be somewhere on the continuum of, that's a busy job, but I've got some time, or it's going to be completely all-consuming and I won't have a chance to see any of my friends. It turned out to be beyond even that. Yeah. So it's a real pleasure to do this, and I love the format. I think it's great. It's really, really creative of you.
I'm super happy to hear that. You know, it's still a young channel. I think I launched it in March. I think today it's episode number 16, so still very young, but I'm super glad always to hear people saying that they like the concept. It's very different, and also I want to show a different aspect of entrepreneurship. I go to so many pitching events, which is cool, but you know, you have the same format that you see over again, and it's good to be able to just sit down, deep dive into someone's experience and journey, and just have a casual discussion, not being like, I have 2 minutes to pitch my idea and then I'm gone.
You'd said to me that you've picked a particularly difficult game, so
yes, today.
See what element of my character that brings out.
Well, it's your fault. You said it. You said on when we discussed, you said, I love video games. So for today, I picked a video game that is slightly more difficult than what we used to play. But that's okay. It's not that hard either. I mean, there are not that many buttons, and you know, that's okay. So let's get started maybe with your own experience. I know that you've done lots of different things before joining Oyo. So maybe can you give us a bit of background of what you've been up to?
So like all good aspiring technologists or technology entrepreneurs, I studied history at university. And then I'd done that not with any particular intent when I went to university, of knowing what I wanted to do afterwards. Classic Western liberal education. But at university, I got to meet a lot of very technologically enabled people who sort of taught me about things like Twitter, which at the time was sort of totally revealing. Having had no exposure to it before, it suddenly dawned on me that it's going to be the medium through which you can revolutionize the way the world works. I mean, it's a pretty obvious statement, but I went through a few different jobs, always trying to figure out how can I be part of that kind of limitless creativity or that limitless opportunity to change the way that things are already done. So I started out in management consulting for my sins, which in some ways was an amazing start to my career. In some ways, it sort of can constrain your thinking. So I'm sort of always drawing on the lessons that I learned, kind of generalist skill set that I learned, but in some ways always sort of trying to unlearn the way that corporate America likes to do things.
Yes.
I went to San Francisco with them as a way of trying to, again, kind of get closer to that culture, and then came back to work for a startup in London in the sort of rental, housing rental space, trying to solve the problem of how you find a place to rent, but doing it from the consumer side.
Funny story about that. I just started a new job on Monday.
And congratulations.
Thank you. And I think I am in the same office almost as they are.
Oh, right.
Yeah, when I was looking at your profile, I recognized the logo. And I think they're just next door. And I was like, is this really the same company? Could it be?
Probably is.
so that was quite a funny thing to find out. But please continue.
So I went into a kind of operations role there. And that's where I really cut my teeth understanding how technology and product development works. You know, I read a lot of blogs and as kind of we all have, and there's so much content now online, you can't move for advice on how to operate this or how to fundraise that or how to deal with your cap table investment, whatever it might be. But I remember when I started trying to read some of these things in 2009, I mean, there was a handful of blogs. I mean, there was kind of Mark Andreessen's blog, I think, Fred Wilson, and
but it wasn't like today where you could actually find so much content that you don't know where to start.
Exactly. Medium didn't exist, and making it sound like I'm old. I'm not. It wasn't that long ago. But, the Lean Startup hadn't come out. So the sort of productization of knowledge, if you will, within the space hadn't really kind of emerged. Mm-hmm. I think because we were still kind of in what some of the earlier phases of, let's say, the modern tech boom. So that's where I really sort of cut my teeth for a couple of years, understanding what it's actually like to develop a product with customers. It's funny, sitting with you here, I'm reminded of someone who I work very closely with to kind of handcraft, you might say, our first product. Also a French lady who with whom we went out and spent an enormous amount of time with customers trying to figure out what their problems were, then building software with it, and kind of became product manager. Had an incredible technical team there. There's a guy called Jack who I learned an enormous amount from, still very close to today. Built an operations team, got to a certain stage, and then in order to kind of push on my learning, I went to try and start my own business. I know your podcast, what I call this, a video cast?
Well, yeah, that's a big question. I don't know yet. I generally just use the live video stream or stream, but it doesn't necessarily ring a bell for everyone, so podcast is fine.
So entrepreneurs playing games. I noticed it's called entrepreneurs, and so I wanted to try the entrepreneur component. Really interested in the gender pay gap, which led me towards affordable childcare for lots of reasons I could go into, I guess. And spent the next 18 months sort of realizing that I wasn't ready to build a business for a number of reasons.
Okay.
The really fortunate thing for me in that period was to spend some time with Entrepreneur First. I think back to my kind of nascent interest at university, I mentioned about technology being able to sort of change the way the world works and not really being sure how. That's really the core thesis. One of the, I hope I won't misquote them, but one of the sort of underlying beliefs of Entrepreneur First is that technology, entrepreneurship is, technology has always been the sort of fundamental agent of change in society.
I think we haven't necessarily talked about Entrepreneurs First on the channel yet. So can you just really quickly talk about the program and what it is in a few seconds?
So I think, I mean, I'm slightly blushing, but I think Entrepreneur First is one of the most innovative and interesting ideas around and has been for some time. The core idea is that you can invest in exceptionally talented people before they become a company, before they sort of form to become a company. And I think accelerators like Y Combinator and others are well known for investing in early stage companies that have some sort of traction, some sort of product. What's incredible at Entrepreneur First is that they're willing to go one step before. And in my mind, they've almost sort of pulled back behind Series A, behind seed, and created a new category, which they call talent investing, whereby they have a pretty good way of finding people who they believe can create the next Google or whatever it might be. And they provide them with a stipend, so they pay them effectively a salary, and 100 people come into a room, broadly most of whom are extremely technically capable, PhDs, often professors, people have written books about, I mean, literally written the book about
most,
you know,
of them actually
computer vision.
Cambridge PhD or,
It's a very broad mix actually, so it's very international as well. And there are some sort of non-technical people, and I was one of those. And the outcomes have been incredible. I forget the exact number, so I'd have to check, but I think they've been, I would say in the order of sort of 30, I'd say around 30, maybe even more, 40 cohorts around the world. every 6 months. So they've started in London, they're in Singapore, Bangalore, Paris. I actually helped to open the Hong Kong office, which unfortunately had to shut. I don't think the talent was inbound as much, possibly related to events of recent, over the recent years or so. And yeah, the outcomes are incredibly resilient teams, even though the people didn't know each other beforehand, and that's been a key lesson for them. I think the portfolio of companies is worth something around $2 billion.
Yeah, it's they have a really large portfolio with so many companies going out of the program every year. I think that the main thing for entrepreneurs or people who want to be entrepreneur is that it's a great way to find co-founders. I've met lots of founders that have been through the program, not because they need help with finding the idea, but sometimes just because they need to find a co-founder that is ready and that has the same kind of vision. And I think that that's one of the few programs you can join to find someone to start with.
So I was there for a while. And then, like you, spent some time freelancing. And then wanted to kind of double down on my operator experience. And I was looking for mentorship and growth, and I found both at Oyo, which I joined last year. And in that time, we have grown from, so I should explain, Oyo is a hospitality brand, started out of India, one of the very few global companies that, that, at least that I'm familiar with, that has grown from east to west, as opposed to west to east. There's a map that they often show internally with all these global brands which cover some part of the world but are missing US or missing China. But Oyo is in 85 countries or so. And when I joined last year, we had four hotels with our brand over the door, and I was employee 25 or thereabouts.
Okay.
We now in the UK have around 220, 230 hotels with our brand over the door.
Nice.
And we're over 500 employees. And so my role has been to help build the company.
Your title is Chief of Staff,
right?
That's a title that we see more and more, especially in scale-up companies. But I think depending on the company, it may change a lot, and lots of people may be confused by this title that kind of include lots of things, but you don't know exactly what. So what is part of your job right now?
I mean, I'm not actually a fan of the job title. And it's, I said to my boss at the time, you know, I can be many things to you, but the one thing I don't want to be is chief of staff. And so he came back 3 weeks later and said, how about you be chief of staff? But I think it's, you know, it's instructive that I only had that conversation with him 6 months in. You know, I guess there is a, as you and I think many others would recognize, there is always too much to do. And there is always, you don't have a neat set of departments or capabilities or skills that just have to be filled, because the organization, a high growth organization, is changing so quickly, that the demands are changing so quickly, and there are always more problems, and there is always more work to be done than there are necessarily people who have the right skills and the right competencies. So I think, again, as you and others will recognize, one of the key strengths or requirements in an early stage company is people who can adapt to everything. And any founder, CEO watching this will know that, you know, they're the, whatever the phrase is, they're the cleaner and the sort of head of sales and the sort of can often be the chief engineer and so on. And I think the chief of staff role is that partner to the founder, to the CEO, to whomever it might be, who can jump on any problem. And so in my experience, that has been being a regional general manager, so building, scaling, and then operating a team for a couple of months. So not a long time, but in that time we went from, I don't know, about 5 to 50 people. And, you know, there's a lot of things that just need to happen. Building the basic data infrastructure on day one when I first joined, how many hotels, how many people are joining, you know, what's going on, what's the visibility, what's the cadence of communication to the senior leadership, which was about three of us. But, you know, very quickly it was 5 and then 10. And most recently, I've been heavily involved in our strategic planning, as well as playing a role sitting over a leadership gap, so in our kind of operational infrastructure, We've been looking for a VP for a while, and I've been playing that parts of that role for 3 or 4 months. So it's constantly changing. I'm now sitting over a significant part of the sales operation. So it's a very interesting role because it gives you a very wide perspective on lots of different parts of the business. So it can be sort of broad in terms of the different verticals or different components of the business you might cover, and it can also be, you know, on another axis, it can be sort of anything from assistant right through to kind of VP in any. So you can be sort of anywhere in that paradigm. But I think at some point, I think for me at least, you probably want to start owning some discrete component of the business. You can be jack of all trades for a long time, and it's great for personal growth, especially when you go from 20 to 500 people, 550 people in a year. It's a lot of very interesting problems you get to see. It gives you that helicopter view, but I think for me at least, it's something that you probably want to pick something once the organization stabilizes a bit.
That sounds like a super interesting role, and I'm glad to see more and more companies having some people like that. Filling between the gaps and also connecting. I feel that when you grow,
I think that's very true.
Having connection, like you can build a new department, great, but then if it's the department, it's not really well integrated with the rest of the company, there is a problem. So having people filling the gaps is really great.
I think you're completely right. And I think one of the things that is amazing to me in high growth companies, and you know, I've been in high growth companies, I've been in sort of medium growth companies, you know, I've been in very, very early stage companies, but one of the things that has been fascinating, I mean, there are lots of adjectives I could use, but as is quite widely reported, I suppose SoftBank were investors in Oyo, which is maybe a topic for a different day. I mean, that's been a very interesting thing to observe, and I've got a whole load of
presumptions
about that. And anyway, so I've sort of slightly human guinea pig myself into that scenario. But one of the interesting things has been very few companies, let's say, have ever grown at that kind of pace. And so what it creates, to your point, is a lot of siloization or a lot of silos where people are so rigorously focused on hiring 20, 30, 40 people into their team and delivering topic A, B, or C, which itself may change every day, that all of a sudden you might have, say, 5 areas of the business which are going like this very, very quickly, because the opportunities for the leadership in those independent parts to come back together and sort of stay aligned are actually quite rare, because there's so much kind of innovation happening or change happening across the business, but even within the individual departments is doing this. So I always often think of myself as the cable tie. So as people start to do this, I sort of try to cable tie things back a bit, and then they start to do that again and constantly diverge. But you're right, the connection, the communication, and the ability to try and pull up and just say, okay, everyone, let's just pull up and check in. Where are we going? Why are we doing this? And how are we helping each other or not?
Something that you mentioned and I want to hear a bit more about is your startup experience as a founder. You mentioned that you joined EF and you started a business there, but at the end, it didn't really work out. And I think for some time, I really wanted to have also someone to talk about what happened when you fail, and not necessarily spending too much time on it, but what was the startup about and what really happened?
So I think usually when you would talk to someone about their having started a company, they'd be able to give you a pretty clear answer or a clearish answer on, here is the problem, here's the product, you know, here's what I did and here's why it worked and here's what didn't work. I think I can't say I ever got to that stage, because I was my challenge, and one of the reasons that I wasn't able to see it through is, and again, this comes back to what I mentioned earlier about being slightly ruined by the start of my career in corporate strategy, is the tendency to sort of try to answer all the problems in theory and to sort of overthink the problem and overthink the solutions, actually a sort of a healthy dose of naivety and let's see what happens, and a conviction to kind of start running in a direction is much more as far as I can tell, it's a necessary requirement to get going, at least in the kind of entrepreneurship that we're probably familiar with. And I think I was interested in affordable childcare, I was interested in any solution I'd say that's sort of one broad category of thing that I was interested in. And then the other broad category of thing I was interested in was somehow improving the access of opportunity to the access to work opportunity for the most talented. So the first, the access to the childcare problem was a non-tech business, and I wanted to create some way of enabling. It seemed to me crazy that we would proactively exclude young parents and usually women from work for both the sort of morally objectionable reason and all of the problems that this creates for women advancing in their careers and men parents as well, but it's almost entirely women who are disadvantaged in this way, and it also seemed to me which you know is a cause and that you know that's interesting enough, but why is it a business? Well, it also seems to me economically indefensible that you would again exclude people from the work environment, people who are highly trained, have an enormous amount of value to add, obviously, and are expensive to replace. And so the first kind of concept I'd worked on was, could you somehow subsidize the costs of childcare and possibly relocate young parents to work in kind of cheaper locations near where they live? Okay. I won't go too much into it unless you've got questions. Not because of anything to hide, because it's a long story. But could you somehow reduce the cost by having kind of work from home / nurseries, workspace / nurseries near to where people actually live? So it's cheaper to have a workspace in Richmond than it is in I don't know Shoreditch.
Yeah.
And at the same time, could you get the workspace to subsidise the nursery in some way?
I see.
So that didn't quite work out. I actually joined EF at around that time, actually as an employee originally, Entrepreneur First EF. And then one of my mentors there said, oh, interesting, why don't you work on a tech business? And I thought, that's a good idea. So then on the technology side, I got very interested in kind of people, talent, and helping discover the right talent opportunities and right for talented people. Who otherwise might not have the opportunity because they're not in the right network. And we've talked a bit about network this morning. It's a great positive, it's a great bonus, but it's also, by definition, can be exclusionary if you're not in the right network. So I think, in general, the access, the development of an access to networks is absolutely a good thing, because it used to be sort of boys' clubs, literally. And at least now with the internet and shows like yours and networking tools and so on, that these things become more open and available to lots and lots of people. But you still have to find your way onto that ladder somehow. So I got very very deeply involved in how we could possibly use reinforcement learning to figure out an answer to this question. And the same problem as the first time around, overthinking it. Being too conceptual, trying to come up with a sort of perfect theoretical answer, very management consultant thing to do. And so my overall experience from that whole year and a half, some of which was working for EF, some of which was trying to start a company, my whole experience was actually don't force it. Someone coming from my entrance into that world was, I want to start a company because, a list of reasons that kind of inspired me. And I think, and again, there's no new insight here, it's just something I learned, my own way. Actually having a healthy disregard for the reasons why you might not be able to do something is important. So having that kind of conviction. But also just kind of picking something and going with it. And you can't just pick something at random. You have to sort of be in the right place, the right frame of mind, usually because you have a deep fascination or interest, but not always, I don't think. I think you can also just be in a time and a place in your life where you're willing to just be a bit more chilled out and to go for it. And I don't think I would say I was chilled out. I would sort of approach entrepreneurship in the same way that I would approach my professional career as I was taught at management consulting, which is to be sort of extremely results orientated, extremely structured, extremely measured. And that's not always the right skill set to deploy.
I know that there are lots of people that I meet that kind of hesitate to start their own business because they think about the career and they have some doubt about their ability to find a job or get back to the life they have if they start a business. They think, oh, maybe if I start something right now, people who would be potential employer, if it doesn't work, they will see this as a failure. Or they might not be able to employ me because of that. Sure. So they have lots of doubts about it, but you managed to do it. You used to be a founder, you tried a few things, you also been an employee, and especially, well, I think when you were at EF, it's kind of, it was a bit of a mix, right? You were building your startups while being there, so that's also a good balance. But what about when you stop doing your own business and you started joining OYO, for example, as a full-time employee?
So transitioning in and out of...
Yes.
So I mean, here's something about which I feel very comfortable and confident, which is that how do I express this? So I was never worried about that at all for a few reasons. One, because, you know, having just said I'm very uptight in certain ways with my management consulting training, I also just feel that you just have to be yourself. You just have to look for things that you enjoy in the world and not try to constrain yourself to, you know, the corporate definition of, of, you know, how you should progress in your career. It's one of the reasons that, you know, I haven't, let me say that there are more traditional paths that I could have pursued having started in management consulting, and that a lot of my friends have gone on to do 3, 4, 5 years at this company, and they've done an MBA, and then they've gone for vice president at that company, and then they've gone into private equity. And I think it's one of the reasons when, you know, earlier on in my career, I was looking at venture capital firms and came very close to joining venture capital. I never quite felt credible to sit across from an entrepreneur and tell them how to run their business, even if I was right. I wanted to go and kind of learn to do it myself and to operate myself. And I think maintaining that kind of honesty with yourself and that flexibility is really, really important, and not trying to achieve someone else's definition of what it looks like. Because ultimately, if you stay true to yourself, it sounds like a sort of self-help book, but if you stay true to yourself and crucially you're always learning, then whatever it is that you, whatever story it is that you want to tell, you can tell, and you can make yourself valuable. So let me be a bit more specific. I could say when I joined my first startup that, you know, I had a series of skills that I developed in the corporate world, and now I wanted to apply those, and it would give me disproportionate leverage because there was a broad set of generalist skills that they just didn't have and that they needed. And so I would give that, and in return I would get some exposure to product and technology in the way that I've mentioned. Going into Entrepreneur First, again, it was sort of the right time. I'd done a bit of big company corporate stuff, I'd done a bit of little company stuff, and so maybe the two together would be the right blend. And then going into OYO, it was very easy. I just said, you know, I've got the core analytical background, I've got the ability to operate in uncertain environments. It didn't work out, and now I want to take the skills that I have and double down on them. I mean, I don't know, perhaps my answer here is a bit vague, but I don't think it's a concern. Okay. I just think be good at what you're good at, be confident about what you're good at, and always just ask yourself, as long as you have some sort of strategy, just always ask yourself, what would I learn, or how am I sort of continuing to add to my sort of Tetris block, if you will. And
I like the reference to the game, that's great.
There you go.
I'm also wondering, I had this question the other day on the stream where someone asked about how to find the right startup to join. And for you, you joined OYO while you didn't necessarily have specifically experience on hotels or anything like that. And I think it's kind of the dream of many people to learn and to advance a career, to join at an early stage a company that is going to scale and to become a very large company. How did you go to join, and what was the feeling? What convinced you?
So I guess to sort of clarify my answer before, always about what are you learning? And I know, again, this is very trite and maybe not, you know, not a unique answer, but I just think it's so easy. People really, you know, whenever people ask me this sort of question, I just say, well, forget the company, company A, company B, company C. Don't be biased by the role that's being put in front of you. Don't try and retrofit your answer to actually a job posting that's come up. Constantly ask yourself, what is it I want to learn? What is my 2, 5, 10 year, whatever your horizon is you're comfortable with, you know, where do I want to get to? And then working back from that, what are the kind of inputs that I need to achieve that? And to me, you know, I'd had experience in smaller companies, I had experience in larger companies. What I didn't have was two things. One, a mentor had told me that I'd never experienced success, which I interpreted as I've never been in an environment that is growing. And so that's one of the things that I wanted with growth. And the other thing that I wanted was the opportunity to manage large parts of an organization at scale, which mm-hmm. just happened to be a part of my skill set that I'd never filled in. And why are those things important to me? Because I want to run my own business. So I want to know what it's like to operate in a high growing yeah. environment so that I'm prepared for that, because it makes me better to run my own business. I want to be, to manage different parts of organization at scale, because I want to have a rough and ready answer. Again, it's why the chief of staff role is quite useful to me, because it gives me a broad view over lots of things, which hopefully I'd like to be involved in. And so I went looking for my next job with two very, well, I actually had three and I had to compromise on one, but I had three very clear objectives. One, high growth, which is the personal learning that I mentioned. So the highest growth possible would be great, because I saw very much this step in my career as recharging. Having tried to be an entrepreneur and understood why I wasn't able to do it, I wanted to kind of recharge, learn some more, or as a friend described it to me, you know, oh, it's a bit like doing an MBA, you're sort of going to do your time, before I could then go and reinvest what I learned. So growth. The second is absolutely critical, and I would never compromise on this, which is mentorship. Really to work for and with people who inspire me every day. Mm-hmm. And I won't embarrass my, I mean, you could find out, but the person I who led Oyo in the UK is one of the most phenomenal individuals I've had the opportunity to work with, and from whom I learned an enormous amount. I'd say the same, entrepreneur first, again, incredible talent network, mm-hmm. wonderful people. The third thing I wanted was exposure to deep or innovative, deep technology, I guess, sort of cutting edge technology in some way. On that, I had to compromise.
Okay.
You know, Oyo is powered by lots of interesting technology, but it's hospitality and hotels led business. So those are the two things that I wanted, and as you said, hospitality isn't anywhere in that story.
Yeah.
And it doesn't need to be, and I'm open about that with my colleagues. You know, mm-hmm. I'm interested in the problem, sure, but it's more about learning as much as possible at scale from great people.
But I guess it's good to be able to be open about it. I feel that there are lots of people who may have some doubt before even going to an interview or else to talk about this aspect, because they're not covering the entire spectrum of the role, share the same passion for all the same steps. And I think it's really good that you can actually talk about that with your colleagues and people within your team.
Yeah. I mean, there's maybe an emerging theme in my career, which is real estate, but generally speaking, and you know, this is a blessing and a curse, but generally I've been a generalist, you know, management consulting, startup, trying to build my own company, and then doing then actually as a freelance consultant, and then doing some kind of more startup. But I never went and said I'm the hospitality guy. But I don't want to be the hospitality guy. I want, you know, like a lot of your viewers and other people, I'm interested in lots of different things.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, in some ways that's the sort of management consultant's curse, because you can be interested in jack of all trades and not focused on one. And at some point, I think I'll need to. I will need to build functional expertise, and or industry expertise, and I've come to have more and more respect for that. And I don't think I'll want to be a generalist for my whole life.
Okay.
But it keeps my options open. But I want to be known. Sorry, I'll rephrase, as the functional expert, as a sort of operational leader, or potentially as a sales leader, given that that's what I'm doing at the moment. Someone who's able to kind of inspire and build inspire people to build great organizations and be part of a growing business without necessarily being and the hotels guy or this guy. And you know, part of the reason for that is so much is changing. There's so much opportunity that I think as long as I'm able to be able to reapply or adapt in the modern workforce, I think at least for now, it's good to keep my options open.
Completely understand that. Something that is interesting is that you mentioned earlier that you joined the company You were employee number 25, something
about
like that.
Yeah.
Now there are 500 people part of the company. That's huge. That's a big change. So you may have seen a lot of different stages and changes over time, I guess. So you mentioned that your role has changed a lot, but it's also part of your role to be involved in different steps.
Yes.
Since you are kind of the glue within the company, what kind of stages or things that you've seen growing massively your workforce?
So there have been 4 or 5 distinct phases, I would say.
Okay.
I don't know if they're all in equal size and shape, but I would have thought in any other environment I might get exposure to one of these every 18 months, and it's been more like every 2 or 3 months.
Okay.
And this has all happened within a year. Now, obviously, if it happens that quickly, it doesn't mean that it happens with the same level of rigor and the same depth. So, but it still happened. The first is what you might call the sort of handcrafting phase. 20, 25 people trying to figure out how you build a supply function, how you build an infrastructure function and an operations function, and also interact with the technology that's based out of India, but also build a lot of the reporting and the strategy, the data that helps you actually operate. And you've got an HR and legal, or, you know, and that kind of jack of all trades sort of running around. It's really the most fun part.
Okay.
And in all the experiences I've been in and with people I've spoken to, when you have landed on something and the product market fit is emerging, and it's a different, slightly different story with Oyo, because we picked up a product that was working in India and we sort of landed it in the UK. Mm-hmm. So I can't pretend that we sort of, it's not a real sort of startup from the inception, and kind of handcrafting the product in the way that, you know, others are. So, you know, I recognize there's a there's a difference there, but still running around and kind of building stuff from in the early days is really fun, and you have very strong relationships and bonds with the people that you're doing it with. We then moved in from being a centralized organization in London of 25, 30, 40, 50 people, and we got to about 50 in, would have been in about February, I would guess.
Okay.
February, March. I joined in January. We kind of devolved. We started hiring general managers. And said, right, Scotland, you run your own team, build your own operations and so on, instead of us shipping people up on the train as we used to. Same in the north and in the south and so on. So that was kind of the second phase, was regionalization and devolution from a centralized to a regional organization. Then around the summertime, we started looking at the profitability of our hotels.
Okay.
Classic growth. At some point, you have to see that, you know, you're throwing all this money off a building. Is it actually landing anywhere? Mm-hmm. And then I've most recently been through a leadership change. So our UK CEO left to spend some more time with his family, very young kids, incredibly successful guy, and he got us to a certain stage. And as is being reported in the media, not inaccurately, we live in a post-WeWork world. So profitability across the board is now a big focus. So we're now going through a lot of changes and adjustments to the business model to make sure that we outlive that. And this is kind of the other side of the sort of SoftBank coin. And as I said, I'm slightly experimenting on myself.
Do you feel lots of pressure from the press and from everyone else on the company right now because of that? Was it just more something enterprise?
Not really. So I mean,
the
yeah, there's a few different ways to cut it. So on a personal level, you know, I do sort of, you know, I have conversations with my friends where I just almost have to, I don't know if justify is the right word, but I have to explain that, yes, I understand, as I said to you earlier, and as I said to my friends when I joined a year ago, it's not real.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's you know, the markets have been pretty good at finding the right amount to invest in the right people at the right time in the sort of series and the stages that we've come to know. It's not real when SoftBank just sort of blow all the intellectual thought process behind it away and just say, how about 10 times that tomorrow, or I'll invest in your competitors. So in a way, I sort of have to sort of, I feel like I need to explain to my friends that I understand that, and that in a way, we're kind of going to be victims to that, the kind of pressure and the kind of influence that comes with that kind of money. Do I really sort of care about the sort of press reports and so on? No.
Okay.
The only thing that I care about actually is my colleagues. So, you know, I've been part of this huge hiring process, and there will be adjustments, and there will have to be adjustments, because ultimately you have to build a profitable business. But at the same time, And by the way, there's a whole load of kind of lessons learned, and you might say that some of those lessons were known in advance. So there is something uncomfortable about the impact that these things may have on my colleagues, but that's the lens through which I think about it, and I think, how can I make sure that that everyone is understands and is excited about building the company, no matter what else is happening around. I mean, it's the downside to being part of building the UK business as opposed to being part of building the business from the core.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, there's all this personal growth opportunity and figuring out in this country and so on, but you're sort of one step away from SoftBank throwing so much money at you.
Mm-hmm.
That you're kind of also in execution mode, and you don't necessarily, you do some of the thinking, some of the strategic planning, but not as much as if it was a company of 100-150 people, and the product, the CEO, the founder was all in one place. So it's a bit of a mix.
I see. And what kind of impact did it have on you and on your team in the UK? To have such a large amount of money injected within the company? Did you just went all into, okay, we need to hire lots of people and then we'll figure it out? Did you first started planning really consciously what's going to happen? What was the process as soon as the money came in? Because I think it was a very large investment, a billion.
It was. So I forget the exact numbers, it was about $1.5 billion in September 2018, around the time they actually launched the UK. So in some ways there is no answer to your question, because it's the only reality we've known. That money was put in to launch around the world. So when that money came in, Oyo was in significantly in India and China, so about 15 times the size of the next largest hotel brand in India, and it was emerging number one in China, which it really built within a year and a half, which is remarkable. It is, and there are downsides to that, right? It doesn't come free, and again, I think there's a lot of questions being asked about how deep that growth, how sticky that growth is, if that makes sense, which again, it's an interesting topic and something about which we'll really learn, we'll be able to talk about more when you sort of look back on where we land in years to come. And we had a sort of a very, very nascent presence in Indonesia, Vietnam, Thailand, I think. So very sort of, we started to think about other Southeast Asian countries, but for all intents and purposes, we're in two countries.
Okay.
Fast forward, and then we landed boots on the ground in the UK as the first Western market in sort of December that year, 2018, January 2019 when I joined. So roughly speaking, within a year, September-ish, so 18 months, we'd gone from a presence in two countries to now having 85 countries around the world.
Wow.
So the answer to your question, what's it like when, how much strategy, how much thinking do you do? Not a lot, because the mandate was open the UK and scale it.
Yeah.
And so what sort of thinking and strategic planning and so on there was is constrained within that framework.
Mm-hmm.
And don't get me wrong, there is still a lot, and I think there's a lot of localization and adaptation that you need to do. But when you grow at that pace, I don't know, this sounds almost a bit facetious or a bit like I'm avoiding the question, but you just do what you have to do, and there's you have to hire an enormous amount of people, and you just have to execute, there's an enormous amount of fires burning everywhere, and you have to be okay with that, and you just have to prioritize and focus. I mean, that's been one of my big lessons, I'd say. It's just being comfortable with chaos, which is something I thought I had sort of observed, having been in kind of various startup environments for a few years.
But I guess it's slightly different because it's a different scale also. You're used to have kind of emergencies or things to deal with at a smaller scale, but when it has potentially effect on more people, on more employees, or it's kind of not the same type of emergency or of scale. Right?
Yeah, exactly. And, I guess you have two choices. You can say this is sort of too much and we can't do it well, and you can leave or not join such a company.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can say, hey, this is interesting. how can we make it work? And I think about it all the time as my contribution to that story is, how can I, what can I do to make this a success for our customers, for my colleagues, mm-hmm. you know, and the personal growth stories and the opportunities that everyone who's joined Oyo have been remarkable, have been amazing. And I think that's been the conversation I have with my colleagues again and again and again. It's just at the pace and speed at which they have been able to learn, the resilience mm-hmm. they've built up. And I don't think it's necessarily the only way to build a company. Well, it isn't the only way to build a company, and it's not necessarily the best way for the long term. It's not necessarily right for everyone, but I think as a moment in time, mm-hmm. as a contribution on my own and my colleagues' careers, as a distinct sort of part, a growth opportunity, I think it's been remarkable. Well, certainly that's the conversation I have with, that's the feedback I have anyway.
Something that I find super fascinating is that you've been helping not just Oyo, but also Entrepreneurs First before, growing and expand to other countries. Mm. So I have quite a few questions actually about that. Mm. And the first one is, do you feel that there is a checklist or a sweet spot or a stage that you need to reach before thinking about expanding internationally? And if so, what is this sweet spot?
Interesting. I think there will be better mental models than any that I have. I think there will be better. So I'll take a sort of a stab. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to sort of consolidate what if anything I've observed. So I would say one of the things that that I saw at Entrepreneur First was how important it was to build a local organization. You know, this is a high touch, high quality service. Yeah. It's a luxury service, basically, mm-hmm. that is very closely involved in the personal fortunes of individual people. And the context of those individual people is very, very different wherever you are in the world. The outcome is still the same. The product, the service you want to provide is still the same. Mm-hmm. But it is a service. It's as I said, it's very high touch. And so the approach there, which I think was the right one, was to make sure that the local teams built a local culture. The service was a local delivery culture, let's mm-hmm. say. The service was the core outcomes were still, you know, and the model and so on was still pretty consistent. The product, let's say, was pretty consistent. But it needed to look, feel, and behave like it was built and owned locally. Mm-hmm. And I would say, but that's not true for everyone. I think, you know, Oyo, which is a different type of business, it's a relatively a lower margin in the sense that I'm Entrepreneur First, which is effectively operates like a fund. Mm-hmm. You know, they need to let the individual teams run away and you know, that one or two will return the fund. And if it works, then it's relatively high margin in the long run. Yeah. Whereas Oyo is very different. It's a it's a relatively low margin business, mm-hmm. and you know, it's a technology slice on the top of or a lower margin business, I should say. And I think in order to operate at scale and be and the complexity that it has, very operationally focused, then it you need some sort of consistency. And I don't think you want too much complexity or difference across all of the various geographies. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really answering your question. I'm answering a different question, which is how do you expand internationally?
Well, that's fine. I think, you know, my question are very broad and it's a direction. But if it's more important to think about how you do it rather than the stage and the moment to do it, maybe that's fine.
I think the traditional answer to the question is, I think different people have different opinions on this.
Okay. So it depends very much on your business and how you feel about it, when you want to.
And I think one of the things that people can forget is that just because your product works in one market in one mm-hmm. context does not mean it will work in another. And I don't know I mean, we see it, like, if you just think of any individual product that you might use, I mean, mm-hmm. It's from a consumer perspective, at least, it's very, well, I also in B2B as well, I guess it's very, I think it's very easy to assume that if it works in market A, it's replicable in market B,
mm-hmm.
you know, and on so many different dynamics. You know, I was with a friend last night who works for a very successful business in computer vision, and they launched in the US, and they just got massively litigated. You know, their whole business, but a large part of their business depends on succeeding in the US market, which is, you know, half of the global market for this particular service. And there's just a litigation culture out there, and the whole thing's just been absolutely pushed back and slowed down an enormous amount, even though the core technology is totally transferable.
Sure.
In the EF example, the product is broadly transferable, mm-hmm. but the local delivery and the high touch and the high service culture needs to be much more sensitive.
Yeah.
And then, you know, as I said, somewhere like Oyo is relatively complex in the sense that you've got millions of guests, you've got tens of thousands of hotel partners, and actually when you're operating at that scale, it actually needs to be very, very regimented, mm-hmm. and very consistent. So I guess there's a number of different dynamics. I think people can be too quick to expand or too slow, but I don't know. Very generic answer.
Yeah, I think it's very good because you answer with your own experience, and that's the most interesting thing. And you know, there might not be one answer, and that's completely okay. I mean, most of the time, there is no one answer that fits everyone anyway. So that's very interesting to hear, and to think about the approach is actually even more important.
But I think there are some companies that have done it very well, and there are some that haven't. And I think the ones that have done it well, from what I've seen, they've tested the water, and they've taken the same principles to building their customers, building their product with their customers in new markets. They have at home markets, and Tessian is a very interesting company. And the way that they, I mean, I actually don't know how successful it was, but I know that they had sort of sent someone out there and they sort of test the water, see how it goes. Whereas I think the kind of, into the US that is, whereas I think, which to me feels like the right way of doing it. Whereas I know that, you know, there've been some companies which just lift and drop, you know, the same product and the same service. And guess what? Maybe the product market fit isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's too risky. And I think that's where money can distract you.
Okay.
I think you say, oh, we can do it. This big market looks good on the spreadsheet. Looks good on the slide.
Mm-hmm.
Tick, let's do it. What are you waiting for? Just execute. It's not.
And you don't think.
No, I think
you. It's truly about the approach.
I think you have to maintain the rigor that got you there in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And the rigor is about making sure the customers and the product and the market is all there. And you might have the benefit of money, but as a leadership team, you need to not abstract yourself too much away from the fact that there are, you know, real world market entry problems. You know, Uber had this problem, I think, trying to expand into parts of the world that maybe didn't need it, or you know, it wasn't the right fit for whatever reason.
Definitely. So I ask all my guests about if they have mentors, communities they're involved in, and you mentioned earlier that you have been involved and that had a really significant impact on your career, and just meeting with people and getting some feedback and mentorship even in the company you work with, but outside of the company you've been involved in, what has been the most helpful for your career, or when you have some doubt or some questions, how do you go with that? Do you reach out to some specific communities or specific people?
So I have enormous respect for some of the communities I'm involved in.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the Entrepreneur First alumni group, both the cohort that I was in and the broader alumni group. There's a very active Slack network. Okay. There's lots of places that I can ask. Very helpful, but what I might call broader and maybe lower order questions. Can someone introduce me to a software developer, or can someone explain this thing to me which I don't understand, or would someone be willing to give me sort of 10 minutes to explain how this market works, whatever it might be. So valuable information, but maybe less specific to me as an individual. You know, similar with the Backed Scouts community, if I wanted to kind of get a sense of what are the interesting companies in retail tech right now, drop it in the WhatsApp group. I'm sure I get 4 or 5 interesting responses.
Yes, in 5 minutes.
Exactly. But I think, to me, I've always been I've always really drawn a lot from and valued some very strong personal connections. Mm-hmm. So I'd say at any one time, I think very, and I do think very practically about this, is probably about five, I've probably got a roster of about 10 or 15 mentors.
Okay.
And there's probably five who are sort of particularly active at any one point, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I don't want to drag on all of their time, you know, if I'm not interested in certain areas. But, you know, I've got a mentor in kind of, well, a couple of mentors in sort of political world, and mm-hmm. I've got a couple of mentors in venture capital. I've got a couple of mentors in sort of talent, some in sort of execution. And a lot of these are friends as well, you know, there's a line there. But something that a mentor once said to me was, whatever your mentor is willing to invest in, you invest 10x back. Which comes a bit weird actually when it's your friend, so I don't think about that so much with my friends, but something I think about a lot. And those, the time that individual mentors have given me has been unbelievably helpful. It's shaped all of the way I think about a lot of things.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I try to catch up with them sort of once a quarter or so, there mm-hmm. and thereabouts each, dinner, lunch, drinks, whatever it might be.
Sure.
And yeah, I'll speak to different ones about different things. And you know, for those who aren't sort of also friends, who I see just casually as well, I think they sort of understand that and they're very supportive and helpful, and I'm all, often quite open about it as well. And it also, it's a very strong motivator for me to try to give that time to others if, mm-hmm. if they want it.
Sure.
And so it's something that I'm very, very keen to do. If someone comes to me with a specific question, it's actually the reason I'm here today, because you said that it was interesting, and whether or not I'm interesting to your viewers or not is for them to decide. But I think giving back is absolutely key, because it's the thing that's helped me get wherever I can get to. And it's actually something that I learned at my consulting firm.
Mm-hmm.
Human capital is their product, so they invest very heavily, but the other people, the other consultants there, were unbelievably supportive.
Huge thanks to Freddie for joining me on the stream today, and thanks to all of you for listening to Entrepreneurs Playing Games podcast edition. You can find me on Twitter at @AmandineFlax, and be sure to check out and subscribe to my YouTube channel at youtube.com/AmandineFlax for the full video version of our discussions, all previous interviews, and much more. Also, if you want to join the live stream and ask your own questions to our next guest, Entrepreneurs Playing Games is taking place every 2 weeks on Saturday morning, so keep an eye on our social media, and I hope to see you there very soon.